All right, let's go ahead and get started. Good afternoon. Hey, there you go. You're awake. Good. Okay, well, welcome to Exchange Server 2013 On-Premises Upgrade and Coexistence. Out of curiosity, how many of you have actually already deployed 2013? One person, two people, three, four, five of you. Okay, how many of you are in 2010? All right, 2007. Anyone still on 2003? All right, anybody earlier than 2003? All right, so if you are in 2003, we won't really be talking about that today. There is real no direct way to get from 2003 to 2013, so I'd recommend going and see my upgrade and coexistence to Exchange 2010 session from a couple years ago, and then you can catch up to 2010 and then watch this recording and then do what we say here. But for those of you on 2007 and 2010, I'm going to show you how to upgrade to Exchange 2013. I'm going to walk you through each of the processes. You'll see that they're very similar. There's just a couple extra steps you need to do if you're on 2007. You'll see that it's a fairly seamless and smooth transition, probably some of the better transitions that we've had before. And I'll also walk you through how the transport migration goes and how public folder migrations go as well. How many of you are using public folders today? All right, great. And how many of you plan on continuing to use what we now call modern public folders in Exchange 2013? All right, almost as many hands. Great. Okay, well, today, again, the objectives are just to understand the upgrade and coexistence scenarios. Again, we're going to be focusing on 2007 and 2010. And I think you'll see that the upgrade experience, particularly for those of you who are coming from Exchange 2010, is going to be, again, one of the most smooth and seamless upgrades that you've probably ever gone through. For those of you standing in the back, there are some seats here up in the front, so please do feel welcome to come and get one. If you do have an open seat next to you, go ahead and raise your hand so they can see where to find one. And because this is the last session of the day, we might actually go a few minutes long. So I won't fault anybody if you need to go right at 5:30, but we might go a little bit longer just to make sure we cover everything, and also to give you time to ask some questions and get some answers as well. So let's start with the deployment fundamentals. Let's take the curtains back on those. All right. Now, let's talk about the coexistence scenarios. I've already said what they are. We only support coexistence with 2013 if you're running 2007 and 2010, and then there are some updates that you have to be running for both of those versions in order to deploy 2013 in your environment. And again, we're going to talk about that. In terms of the client access methods, the biggest change here is going to be around Outlook connectivity, specifically Outlook on Windows. Now, just as we've always done, we support the most recent Outlook client and then two earlier versions. So obviously Outlook 2013, 2010, and 2007. With respect to the client access method, though, all of those clients can no longer connect via RPC over TCP. We only allow Outlook over Windows to connect via RPC over HTTP, or what we've called Outlook Anywhere for the last few versions. And so that has led some people to mistakenly believe that we're not using MAPI anymore. That's not the case. We absolutely use MAPI. So when we say RPC over HTTP, that's MAPI RPC encapsulated in HTTP packets. So it just goes through 443 when you're using SSL. Now, for those of you with older non-Outlook clients, Mac clients, Entourage clients, and so forth, those will probably need an upgrade as well. Particularly if you're using a client that supports WebDAV, we haven't supported that for a couple versions now, and so you'll need to move to one of those clients that supports Exchange Web Services. So, of course, the Entourage edition with Exchange Web Services or Outlook Mac for 2011 and later would be the clients of choice. From an Active Directory standpoint, there's a very good chance that you won't have to touch Active Directory at all outside of the schema extensions that you would do as part of the normal Exchange deployment. From an Active Directory perspective, and in particular from a forced functional level, we have not asked you to upgrade your AD for many versions. So we will still happily operate in a Windows Server 2003 forced functional level or any higher forced functional level that you have. Whether you go to a higher level is up to you. There's nothing in Exchange that's going to take advantage of that, so be aware of that. We do, however, recommend that you have 64-bit directory servers, just because Exchange is going to be a 64-bit workload, and in larger enterprises, there will be some extra directory activity, particularly as you start to light up features and use extra functionality. So keep that in mind as well. We do require that in every site into which you deploy Exchange, you do have to have a global catalog server running Windows Server 2003 SP2 or later. Shouldn't be a problem for anyone here because that is the minimum supported global catalog server that you can have in your organization. And then, how many of you use read-only directory servers? Anybody here use those? You can still have those in your environment, but you also need writable directory servers as well. If you have RODCs or ROGCs in your environment, Outlook and Exchange will effectively ignore them. But both Outlook and Exchange do require writable directory servers, so you will have to have them in each site where you deploy an Exchange server and in each site where you have a mailbox user as well. Now, namespaces. How many of you have a non-standard or non-contiguous namespace? Anybody? Fantastic. Not a single hand went up. Well, that's good, because then you don't have any worries in the future. We do support these alternate namespaces, like a single label domain or a disjointed namespace, but we only support them in Exchange because Windows supports them as well. So in the future, if Windows removes support for those namespaces, we'll probably remove support for them in Exchange as well. But the fact that none of you are in one of these non-standard namespaces really means you have nothing to worry about in terms of that support going away. The fact that we changed that won't affect you at all. If, however, you find out later on maybe you were wrong and you are in one of these non-standard namespaces, it probably would be to your advantage to go ahead and move out into a standard namespace prior to deploying Exchange 2013. It's not a requirement, but it is something that we would recommend, again, given that Windows could take support away for those, requiring you to change them later on. And once you've got later versions of Exchange introduced, that could be difficult for you to do. All right, let's talk about the operating system. In terms of OS, we support, again, the most recent OS and the last OS, as we've always done with Exchange. So Windows Server 2012, of course, and Windows Server 2008 R2 with SP1 or later. Now, of course, you're going to get a better experience on Windows Server 2012, and I'll talk about why from a deployment perspective in just a bit. But Windows Server 2008 R2 is going to provide you with a great experience as well. In terms of additions, typically, we always recommend multi-role for Exchange. We've been promoting it for Exchange 2010. It is still our best practice recommendation for 2013. So that means you're going to be running all the roles on one box. Now, in that case, if you decide to deploy a database availability group, you will need to run a version of Windows that includes failover clustering. So that'll be Enterprise or Data Center in Windows 2008 and Standard or Data Center in Windows 2012. In case you haven't heard, there is no Enterprise Edition in Windows 2012. There's just Standard and Data Center, and the only difference between those in terms of functionality is the license agreements you get around virtualization. So you can happily deploy Windows Server 2012 Standard on all of your Exchange 2013 servers and still deploy a database availability group and have that underlying cluster be there. Now, there are some other components that you need. Much of Exchange 2013 is now managed code. So you obviously, you will need the .NET framework. There's also operating system and IIS dependencies that will have to be installed. And then on all of your Exchange servers, you'll also need to install the Unified Communications Managed API, UCMA. That's there because we've split out the UM functionality in between CAS and Mailbox. So even if you do split up your roles and don't deploy multi-role, you'll still need to deploy UCMA on both servers. It is, unfortunately, a hard setup blocking prereq, so even if you're not using unified messaging, you still need to deploy this on your servers. Now, I mentioned 2012 has an advantage from a deployment perspective over 2008. Everything on this list except UCMA is included in Windows 2012. You don't have to download it separately like you do on Windows 2008. So if you want a nice, smooth, and streamlined experience, that's going to be your best bet. The UCMA can also be scripted and silently installed, so as you're having your Exchange deployments go, not only can you script the deployment of the UCMA bits, but you can also tell Exchange itself to install the Windows components that it needs and have everything be an automated deployment for you as well. It's pretty slick. Now, how many of you are familiar with the architectural changes we've made in 2013? Only a few of you. Okay, so I'm glad I included this slide. I realize we've been talking about Exchange 2013 for more than a year, but I wasn't sure that everyone was up to date on what we actually did to it. So this is actually showing you some major significant differences between the Exchange 2010 architecture and 2013. For one thing, the biggest change is we've consolidated all of the server roles. Where we had a separate CAS, hub, UM, and mailbox role, we've now combined all of that functionality into the mailbox role in Exchange 2013. And we've introduced a new role, we've rewritten a whole new role, but it's still called the client access server. But the client access server that we have in 2013 is nothing like the legacy CAS server we had in 2010. All of that functionality now exists as the client access service inside of the mailbox role on 2013. And so the client access server in Exchange 2013 is nothing more than a thin stateless protocol proxy that provides basically three functions. A lightweight protocol proxy for HTTP, POP, and IMAP. A secondary protocol proxy called the front-end transport, which is an SMTP proxy. And then a UM call router, so that if a unified messaging caller calls in, or if there's a SIP request going to CAS, CAS will initially answer that and then give a SIP redirect and redirect that caller to the mailbox role directly. With the exception of that UM redirection, where UM callers connect directly to the UM service on the mailbox, all other clients, including PowerShell, connect always and only through CAS. No other clients can connect directly to mailbox in this architecture. So in consolidating the roles, we took the middle tier functionality and put it into the back end, into the mailbox server. And then at the top tier, or the client access server, we left it just doing lightweight things like authentication, proxying, and redirection. So that is all CAS does right now. The mailbox has everything else. It's got, again, the legacy client access, which includes RPC client access. It's got the legacy transport, so all of hub transport now exists in mailbox. It has, obviously, the old mailbox role, and it's got the legacy UM role, where most of the UM services live on the mailbox role as well. And, of course, it's got the information store and content indexing, both of which have also changed. We've moved away from that traditional legacy information store, store.exe, and we've introduced in its place the managed store. If you come to my tips and tricks session later this week, I'll drill down a little deeper into all of that as well. So you can see now that we're split out, we just have the two server roles. We've also simplified load balancing up at the top. We still support the session affinity load balancer, layer 7 load balancers, but we no longer require them like we did in Exchange 2010. Now you can get away with just TCP affinity, or what we call layer 4 load balancing. And depending on your availability needs on a per protocol basis, either one of those may be able to function perfectly for you. So load balancing and namespaces also got a lot simpler in this re-architecting of Exchange. So let's talk about the upgrade and coexistence path. So what I have here is I've got two sites. We're going to walk through the Exchange 2010 path first, and then we're going to do the Exchange 2007 path. I do want to point out one thing. Again, earlier I mentioned that we heavily promote multi-role, and we do. But what I've done here is I've just split out the role simply for the animation purposes. So in your organization, it doesn't matter if you've got single-role servers or multi-role servers. The process will be exactly the same. So generally what we have, again, is two sites. I've got my internet-facing site. This is where my namespace is located. And then I have a non-internet-facing or intranet site. We always recommend that you start with the internet-facing sites. And if you have more than one, do them one at a time. Once you're done with those, go ahead and upgrade your non-internet or your intranet sites. Up here, I just have two namespaces that I'm using in my Exchange 2010 environment, my auto-discover namespace, and then I've used a single email namespace for all of my protocols and all of my client access methods. So the process goes like this. First, you verify that your setup meets the prerequisites. So that may mean installing some extra software in your environment to get ready for the upgrade. It's also going to be installing, at a minimum, the legacy service packs that are required for coexistence. And that includes your edge transport service as well, not just the internal server roles. And then you'll validate existing client access. And that validation step is something that you're going to do periodically throughout the deployment. After you've done a certain step in the deployment, you always want to validate and verify that things are good before you proceed to the next step and so forth. So you'll see that as a recurring theme, this validation process. Then you deploy Exchange 2013, and you'll deploy both server roles, again, either in a multi-role or split roles. But you do need both roles for functionality. I'll explain why that is in a bit. Then you'll deploy your certificates, possibly obtain them if you don't excuse me, if you don't already have certificates. And then you'll deploy them on your CAS servers. You don't need to worry about deploying anything on Mailbox because we use self-sign certs there. Then you'll go ahead and do what we call switching the primary namespace or cutting over the namespace. That's nothing more than just going into DNS and changing the IP address for the FQDNs, for those mail URLs, so that they now point to the load balancer that's in front of your 2013 infrastructure instead of 2010, which is where they point now. After you've done that, you can validate that again. There's tools that we'll talk about to help you validate that from an internal and an external perspective. Then you can go ahead and start moving your mailboxes, and that's a process where you create a new DAG. We can't have a 2010 and 2013 DAG coexist, so you'll build a new DAG, and then you'll do the online move mailbox and move your mailboxes from the old DAG to the new DAG and decommission that. Once you've finished upgrading this site, you simply move on to your next site at that point, and you would repeat for each additional site. Now, I know we just went really, really fast through that, but don't worry, we're going to drill into each one of those things in detail in a moment. Just wanted to give you the overview real quick. Now, here's the very same situation, except instead of 2010, now we're running 2007. And you'll see the process is very, very similar. There's just a couple extra things that you need to do if you're running 2007. But it's going to start out the same way. You need to verify the prerequisites are there. You need to install the legacy coexistence updates in the environment on all of your servers. You need to validate client access and make sure everything's ready for the upgrade. Then again, you'll go ahead and deploy CAS and Mailbox for 2013. After you've done that, here's the one extra step that you need to do for 2007. In Exchange 2010 and 2013, they can share the same namespace. There's intelligence that we put into 2010, specifically to future plan for this. So 2010 knows how to coexist with just the one namespace, mail.contoso.com, if you will. 2007, unfortunately, we didn't have a mechanism where we could teach that to 2007 as easily as we could 2010. So 2007 needs a separate second namespace that is used for internal silent redirection only. We refer to that as the legacy namespace. It's just a new namespace that you create, a new DNS entry that you create, and then a configuration that you set in Exchange 2013 to tell it what namespace you're using so that when a 2007 mailbox user goes through a 2013 CAS, the 2013 CAS knows how to redirect or send them to the 2007 mailbox to get their information. Now, some customers have taken this quite literally and actually created a namespace called legacy.whatever their domain is. And that's fine. If you want to do that, that is perfectly valid. But I should mention, there's nothing in Exchange that is hard-coded to look for the word legacy. We just call it the legacy namespace. So you can use any namespace you want to. You could call it oldexchange.whateveryourdomainis.com or some other name that you prefer to use because of your naming standards. Any other name is what it needs to be. But it's not just a name. You also have to put that name on the certificate as well, so you will be obtaining new certificates because when we redirect to 2007, that will be an SSL termination endpoint, and we'll need a certificate there to do that, and the certificate has to have that legacy namespace on it. So you come up with a legacy namespace. You put it into DNS. You order new certificates that have your new namespace and your legacy namespace on them and auto-discover. And then you deploy those on your 2007 CAS and your reverse proxies as well. Then you'll switch the primary namespace. Again, that's just a DNS change. Then you'll build a DAG, move your mailboxes, and because you're coming from Exchange 2007, this will also be an online mailbox move as well. So your users will not have any interruption as their mailbox is moving from the old system to the new system. Yes, sir? That is a fantastic question. I'm going to be talking about that in a little bit when I mention our certificate best practices, but great question. And then, of course, once you're done with the mailbox moves, then you would go ahead and repeat for those additional sites. Again, do each of your internet-facing sites one at a time. Once you're done with those, do your intranet or non-internet-facing sites one at a time. All right, so now let's dig into each one of these steps and see what we're actually talking about. So one of them is going to be these prerequisites. So we've already talked about the AD requirements, the fact that in every site you have to have a writable directory server that is running Windows Server 2003 SP2 or later. That is just a hard requirement. Setup will fail if you don't meet that requirement. From an Outlook perspective, we do have specific updates to the Outlook client that we do require you to have, but we also have later updates to the client that we strongly recommend. So, for instance, the that August 2013 update for Outlook 2007, that fixes some very critical, a very bad bug in Outlook where Outlook confuses the internal and external settings. So if you're using Outlook 2007 in your environment, we strongly recommend that update. We don't require it in setup because it's not required for you to run, but it will make your life a lot easier that you have it. And as I mentioned, RPC over HTTP is the only way we allow Outlook clients to connect. That will also have an implication for any other applications you have in your environment that use MAPI CDO, because MAPI CDO applications also tend to use RPC over TCP as their connectivity as well. Those applications will need to be changed to use RPC over HTTP, and that will have to happen either programmatically by the application developer, or if your application uses a MAPI profile, by the administrator who can just go in and change the MAPI profile to use Outlook Anywhere and uncheck the RPC over TCP box. And again, any web dev-based clients you have cannot be used. They'll need to be upgraded to later versions as well. All right, now in terms of the prerequisites, we've talked about the operating systems and the additions that are required. Again, it's really the database availability group that will drive you to the version of Windows that includes failover clustering. If for whatever reason you do decide to separate out your server roles, there is no reason whatsoever to use anything other than the standard edition of Windows for dedicated client access servers. So if you wanted to use Enterprise in 2008 or Data Center in 2012, then you may be spending more money on the OS than you need to. Yes, sir? Yes, it is Windows Server 2008 R2. Yes, it has to be R2 with SP1 or later. So the generic... No, 2012 R2 is not yet supported yet. Yes, 2012 R2, yeah. That is not yet supported. For those of you who are hoping that support will come soon, I obviously can't give you any dates, but I will say when our next cumulative update comes out, it won't be in there, so keep that in mind. But yeah, eventually there will be support for that, of course, because that's one of the things that we try to do in an update as soon as possible. We talked about the other requirements, that .NET framework, the Windows Management framework as well, which gives you remote PowerShell and WSMan and some of the other things. Those are needed, but again, if you are running Windows Server 2012, those are in the box. You don't have to download them separately. If you're running 2008 R2, you will have to download them separately and keep track of them as part of your deployment process, so keep that in mind. Now, you need to install the coexistence prerequisites on all of your legacy servers. For Exchange 2010, that's going to be Service Pack 3. For Exchange 2007, that's Service Pack 3 plus Rollup Update 10. And you need to deploy these not just on all of your internal servers, but you need to deploy them on your Edge transport servers as well. How many of you are running Edge in here? Just a few of you, okay. So not only will you need to deploy them on Edge, but you'll actually have to redo your Edge subscriptions as well. That is how we find out that your Edge servers have been updated from an internal AD standpoint. Once you establish an Edge subscription with a transport server, we capture the version information and we store it in the internal Active Directory. When you run Exchange 2013 setup, we examine that internal Active Directory, and even if you've deployed the update, if you haven't done the Edge subscription again, we won't recognize that you've done the update, and setup will block you and say you haven't installed the prereqs. So just remember with Edge, it's update and then redo the Edge subscription. Now, in terms of preparing an Active Directory, this is the only place where Exchange is going to make changes to AD. But they will be irrevocable changes. We're going to be extending the schema. We're going to be adding all new classes and attributes to support all the Exchange objects that are about to be deployed. Now, just as we've done in previous versions of Exchange, you can go ahead and prepare your Active Directory, including the schema and the organization and the domains, separately using these switches, or you can simply let the first server that you install do all of that for you. If you don't do these things separately, absolutely the first server you install is going to do all these things. So just keep that in mind. If you're in a very large distributed Active Directory environment, you probably want to go ahead and do the Active Directory prep stuff separately. because you want to wait for AD replication to occur throughout the environment before you actually begin the exchange setup process. In a small environment, it's not such a big deal. There may be a good chance that exchange is actually talking to the same directory server that was just that just had the updates applied to it. But in a large environment, exchange can actually talk to one that doesn't have the updates yet, and it may slow you down in terms of your deployment. So just keep that in mind. You might want to stage it if you've got a large environment. Now, the next thing is to deploy both servers. And, that experience has changed a little bit. Now, in Exchange 2010, we had two forms of setup. We had setup.exe, and that was there to provide you with the GUI version of setup. And then we had setup.com, which was there to provide you with the command line version. Now we just have one executable, setup.exe. If you run that executable without switches, it launches the GUI. If you run it with switches, it launches the command line version. Makes it nice and easy for you. If you do launch the GUI, it's obviously gotten very simplified because there's just two server roles that you can deploy, and the management tools get deployed by default there. Now, you do need to install both Mailbox and CAS in every AD site. Remember, CAS is just a lightweight protocol proxy, but it does form the authentication and connection point for all clients. But Mailbox is where PowerShell lives and all the objects live and so forth. So you can't connect to Mailbox directly. You have to go through CAS. And if you just have CAS, connecting to that doesn't get you anything because CAS needs to proxy you to a Mailbox where all the objects are. So you have to have both roles in every single site. And again, multi-role is our preferred recommendation. When you do install them, if you're installing it via command line, there is this new parameter that you have to put on every command line install that you do. And that means fresh installs and any cumulative updates that you install as well. It's this very long, I accept Exchange Server license term switch. Yes. So there's no abbreviating that switch. There's no tab complete. You have to type it out. You don't have to type it initial case like that. You might type it in all uppercase so you can shout it at the screen, but you do have to type it just like that with every command line you install. There's actually a really legitimate reason that we made this change. It's a very valid reason. If you think about the command line install in Exchange 2010, when setup runs, it pauses and waits for 5 seconds. If you don't do anything, that is your tacit agreement to the license agreement and setup proceeds. If you don't agree, you touch a key and setup terminates. Turns out, from a legal perspective, having somebody do nothing to accept a license agreement may not be always legally enforceable. Who knew? Well, our lawyers knew, and that's why they told us to go ahead and make sure that just like we make you check the box before you can go next in the GUI setup, we need to get your explicit agreement to the license agreement in the command line setup as well. That's why it's in there. Told you, legitimate, valid reason. We don't like just putting in long things to make your life harder or tricky. There's a really good reason in there. We're trying to make our license agreement actually enforceable in this version. So let's see how we do with this. All right, the next thing, again, this is for 2007 only. This is that legacy namespace. So again, the legacy namespace, there's not really too much to say about that. Any FQDN that you want to create in your environment that you can put in DNS, that you can put on an SSL certificate and deploy on your servers, that's really what we're talking about. And then, of course, once you have decommissioned your 2007 environment, you can go ahead and do away with that legacy namespace. It's only needed as long as you've got mailboxes there. So once your mailboxes are gone, you can get rid of that legacy namespace. All right, now, certificates. Certificates have gotten dramatically improved in Exchange 2013. And actually, I don't mind saying, they were actually very improved in 2010 as well. In 2007, they were not so much. In 2007, I believe we had an MVP describe our certificate experience in 2007 as about as much fun as gouging your eyeballs out with a spoon, okay? Now, I've never done that, but that sounds really bad. So we actually did a lot of work to create this wizard inside the Exchange Management Console in Exchange 2010. Now, one of the other major architectural changes in 2013 is that the Exchange Management Console is gone. So now we have in its place the Exchange Admin Center, or EAC for short, and that is the web-based UI, so it's firewall-friendly, it's very fast, it's very slick, it's touch-friendly if you have a touch screen and so forth. Now we've got that end-to-end certificate story right in EAC as well. So you've got all the graphical tools you need. You can do the certificate request. You can get the cert file to send to your certification authority. Once you get the certificate back, you can use the native tools to import it and then assign the various email services to it as well. It's very, very simple to use. If you've used any of the wizards that a lot of the third-party CAs have out there, it's a very similar experience. I will say, though, it doesn't say it on the slide, but there was a bug that we fixed in the most recent cumulative update in CU2. The RTM and CU1 certificate wizard was actually mixing up the O and OU fields in that in the output. We fixed that in CU2, so you shouldn't have to redo your certs as a result of that, but just keep that in mind. That bug is fixed if you've encountered it. Now, as a best practice, we also allow you to export right from the UI as well. So when you have this one certificate, you can install it on one server, and then through the same type of wizard, you can go ahead and deploy it on all of your other CAS servers just like that. You don't have to travel to each box. You don't have to copy the certificate file. You just have the wizard go ahead and deploy that for you. And then you use the same wizard to assign services as well. The other thing that we've done is right in the admin UI, we are telling you now when your certificates are about to expire. And actually, a lot of that is also for our own benefit in Office 365 as well, because we've been bitten more than a few times over the 7 or 8 years we've been running some online version of Exchange by someone forgetting to renew a certificate, and suddenly clients are locked out of the system as a result of that. So now, when you are 30 days from certificate expiration, right inside EAC, we will generate an alert for the administrator. And if they don't take action and renew their certificate every day until that cert expires, we will generate an alert in EAC to tell them, your cert's about to expire, your cert's about to expire. And it looks something like this. And then you can see details on it, and it'll show you the actual details of the cert so you can see who you need to go and talk to get it renewed. But again, it's all about bubbling this up into the administrator to let them know that a critical piece of their infrastructure needs attention or it's going to cause an end user disruption. So it's a very important thing to keep in mind. Now, from a certificate best practices, certificates cost money. The more names that you put on a cert, the more it's going to cost you. So we strongly recommend, first, minimizing the number of host names that you use, and second, where possible, use a subject alternative name certificate so that you have the benefit of having multiple names on a cert without the security implications of a wildcard certification. We do support wildcard certs, but we strongly recommend against them simply because of the security implications. If someone steals your wildcard cert, then they can spoof any server in your organization and have any of your traffic routed to them, and who knows what malicious things they can do. We will never issue a wildcard cert for Microsoft.com, for example. But a SAN cert is great because it gives you the multiple names, but not just any name, only the names that you specify. So there's much greater security that's involved there. Now, typically, with most Exchange deployments, you'll just need the two names, an auto-discover namespace and a mail namespace. Again, with a 2007 migration, you will need the legacy namespace, but that's, again, a temporary thing that will go away eventually once you've decommissioned 2007. Now, when we talk about the requirements for certificates, obviously we're talking about the requirements for the Exchange workload. If you do combine with Link, for example, Link has very different certificate requirements from us. Link, for instance, in some cases requires the server names in the certs. Exchange does not. There's never any reason to ever, ever, ever put an Exchange server name in your certificate. Even if you're a single server deployment, don't do it. Just abstract the name. It's a best practice. Link, however, has different practices. They also require a certificate that has 1,024 bits, equal to or greater than 1,024 bits. We don't have that requirement, although we would support that certificate with Exchange. So what some CAs have done, they've come out with what they call a UC certificate. How many of you have heard of that? Right, okay. So that is just a name. It's actually not a real thing. Okay, so they're just selling you a type of certificate that can be used in an environment that contains mixed workloads typically associated with unified communications. But you're not going to see Microsoft saying, oh, go get a UC certificate to do this. Again, it's not a real thing that exists. Some CAs sell them in packages. Others don't. They'll just sell you a certificate that happens to meet the both workload requirements. So talk it over with your CA. The overwhelming majority of them have sold certificates to exchange customers all around the world, and they know exactly the types of names that should go on there, and they can actually help you walk through the wizard that's in EAC when you deploy them as well. Oh, and I mentioned CU2 fixes that problem. Okay, so the other best practice, to get you to be able to minimize host names, we also want you to use split DNS. So that's using the same host names internally and externally, mail.contoso.com, but your internal DNS server points to the load balancer internally, and your external DNS server points to your firewall or whatever devices in your perimeter network that's letting them into 443 to the CAS. And split DNS is fantastic because not only does it allow you to minimize the number of host names that you need, but it also means that your users only need one name. They don't have to remember the URL to get email internally versus a different URL to get email externally. They can just have one URL, and wherever they are, it will just get them to the right place. Now, not all customers can use split DNS. It is not a requirement. In fact, I find a lot of universities, particularly in the United States, they just use public DNS. They don't have any internal DNS, so any records that they have, everyone's going to public DNS. So even if I'm sitting on campus, even if I'm in the data center on campus, I'm still going out to public DNS on the internet for my name resolution and then coming back in to find that service in there. If you are in that configuration, that's fine. Just be aware that your traffic will be routed that way from a messaging perspective. But if you have the ability to leverage split DNS, we would strongly recommend that you do that. All right, the next step is switching that primary namespace, and that's going to involve, obviously, configuring load balancing. So you'll have, in the case of 2010, for example, you'll still have your layer 7 load balancer in front of your 2010 infrastructure, and then you'll have a new load balancer in front of your 2013 infrastructure, and that can be a layer 7 or it can be a layer 4 load balancer. Either way, you will need some form of load balancer in there so that we can distribute the load across the CAS servers. That, by the way, is another significant architectural change between 2010 and 2013. In 2010, the load balancer was always in front of your RPC client access array object for your internally domain joined Outlook clients. Well, that was there because internally domain joined Outlook clients would connect RPC via TCP. We don't let them do that anymore. I've mentioned that a few times now. Because they can only connect via RPC over HTTP, or they're going through the RPC proxy now on CAS, they don't talk to that RPC client access server endpoint. As a result, that object no longer exists. And because that object no longer exists, the RPC client access server array also no longer exists, and the namespace that went with that is no longer needed as well. But we still needed to have some form of a term to refer to a group of CAS that are behind the same load balancer in the same AD site. And so we still use the term CAS array. But just like UC certificate isn't a real thing, the CAS array is not a real thing either. It's not an object that you create or manipulate. It's just what we call the group of CAS behind the same load balancer in the same AD site. So you will still have a load balancer in front of your CAS. And then for the legacy namespace, that is something where, again, that's just being used for the 2007 mailboxes so that when a user hits 2013 from a CAS perspective, the 2013 CAS has a namespace that it can redirect them to get to their mail. And I'll show you what that looks like in some client flow diagrams in a bit. You'll switch the namespace in DNS, and then you'll configure Outlook Anywhere. How many of you are already using Outlook Anywhere for all of your clients today? Even your internal clients. Fantastic. You've already set the stage. If you are not doing that, you can go ahead and do that today. If you want to switch all of your internal Outlook clients over to Outlook Anywhere internally, I say go for it because it's going to be a deployment step that you have to do eventually anyway, and you might as well get it out of the way as soon as possible. It won't affect client connectivity. It won't change your bandwidth requirements. It won't change the user experience at all. All it will do is change the underlying protocol from TCP to HTTP from the Outlook client perspective. So if you want to go in and maybe drop those Office admin files on all of your clients through group policy and flip them over to Outlook Anywhere, I say go for that. That's a great thing to go ahead and set the stage. If you don't do it ahead of time, it's at this point that you would need to do that. And in fact, Technically, I should probably have those things changed because you'll need Outlook Anywhere to be functional before you change the namespace. Once you change the namespace and the clients pick it up, they're going to try to connect to that namespace. So you want to make sure that you configure Outlook Anywhere ahead of time. I will make sure I change that in the slide before it gets uploaded so you'll have the steps in the proper order when you download the slides. Now, something else that we brought back in CU2, Outlook Web App, silent single sign-on, silent redirects. Okay, so I emphasized the silent single sign-on part because that was actually the part that was missing. We could do the silent redirect, and that is the user goes to the 2013 CAS, and the CAS server redirects them automatically to the URL they should be using, which would be the 2007 server. But prior to CU2, that user unfortunately had to enter in their credentials again. With CU2, we now have that silent single sign-on as well. So if the user goes in and they authenticate it against 2013, they'll just go right into their 2007 mailbox without being challenged, without having to click a different URL, or really doing anything else. And that is the same whether they're in the same site or different AD site. We've got all those things covered now. All right, so let me walk you through, once the deployment is done, what your client connectivity flow will look like. So what we have here is we're just going to go through the 2010 coexistence scenario and talk about what the experience would be like for someone whose mailbox hasn't been moved yet. So up at the top, I've got my client there in my one mail namespace, mail.contoso.com. I will fire up the client. It will do DNS name resolution. DNS will point to that load balancer. The load balancer will pass the traffic to the 2013 CAS. And at this point, we're talking to IIS. IIS will then authenticate the user, and then once the user is authenticated, Exchange will do two lookups. First, it will look in Active Directory to find out what version this user's mailbox is. And if it's running on Exchange 2010 or 2007, it will do a second lookup within Active Manager to find out where this mailbox is located. And in this case, based on the second lookup, we found that this user's mailbox is still on the Exchange 2010 infrastructure. So what will happen is the 2013 CAS will proxy over to the 2010 CAS, and then the 2010 CAS will talk RPC to the 2010 store at that point, getting the mailbox data and sending it back up through 2013 CAS and back up to the client at that point. Now, again, in a 2010 environment where you're running in a multi-role environment, that is local RPC, that's not off-box or networked RPC. So it's very, very snappy communication. Okay, so that's a very basic coexistence example. Let's mix it up a little bit. Let's say now we're in a multi-site environment. So now I've got my internet-facing site because that's where my namespace is. And over here, we've got a non-internet-facing site where I've introduced the new 2010 stuff. Same client comes in through OWA, hits the load balancer. We do the lookups. We find out now that their mailbox is over in that other site. And we also find that that site is non-internet facing. So because it's non-internet facing, we're going to go ahead and proxy that communication over the Exchange 2010 CAS. And again, the 2010 CAS will communicate via RPC to the local store. We call that a cross-site proxy request when that happens. Okay, let's mix it up a little bit more. Now let's say this is actually an internet-facing site. And we know that because it's got its own namespace, and it also has the external URL value configured in Exchange as well. So the client will come in through the load balancer, talk to IIS, we'll do the lookups, we'll find out that they're over there, but we'll also find out that this is an internet-facing site. So what we'll do is instead, we'll go ahead and redirect the Outlook or the OWA client, and it will then connect to that other namespace, and that load balancer will drop them down and silently sign them in CU2 and take them right into their Exchange mailbox. Okay, pretty cool. Now let's make things a little tricky. Let's add Exchange 2007 in the mix. So we're done with 2010 for now. Let's see how the 2007 experience is. So here again, remember 2007 needs that legacy namespace in front of it. Okay? We can't proxy to 2007. We have to redirect to it, and we can't use the same namespace or we'll get caught in a loop with 2007. So we need some other namespace to redirect to, and that's what that legacy namespace is there for. So the user comes in. They're going through the 2013 front door. We find out that their mailbox is over there on 2007. Of course, we've got a legacy namespace, so we're going to go ahead and redirect them over to that server, and that server will then talk, or the load balancer, rather, will talk to the CAS, and CAS will talk to mailbox and, again, get them in their mailbox. Once again, with CU2, this is all happening silently, both the redirection and the sign-on. So they just authenticate once to 2013, and they're in their 2007 mailbox without doing anything else. Once again, we'll add another site over there. This is where things start to get a little tricky and a little different now, because that's a non-internet facing site. So in this case, we're going to go through the load balancer, authenticate with IIS, find out that they're over there, but it's in a non-internet facing site. We don't have a namespace over there that we can redirect directly to. So instead what we do is we'll redirect them over here to where we do have the namespace, the legacy namespace in this case, and we'll go through the load balancer, and then that CAS, the 2007 CAS, will then proxy that communication to the 2007 CAS in the other site. One thing I want to point out, though, is in this animation, the fact that this line is going through the 2013 CAS, don't be fooled by that. The 2013 CAS doesn't come into play. It was just the only way to get the line from there to there on the drawing. Okay, so don't be fooled by that. 2013 CAS is not involved in this. We proxy from 2007 CAS to that 2007 CAS, and then that talks RPC to the store. Yes, sir. With the ActiveSync? Oh, that gets a little trickier. I've got a chart where we'll talk about ActiveSync in just a minute. ActiveSync is a little interesting because in the 2007 case, it also goes through a 2013 mailbox as well. It's kind of unusual. In fact, it's probably the most unusual in terms of the client flow that we have. Okay, so one more variation of this. Now, instead of being an intranet site, now it is an internet-facing site. So, excuse me. And it does have a separate namespace for us to use. So we'll go through here, authenticate, find that the mailbox is over there. We'll go ahead and redirect them. Only in this case, we now have a namespace over to there to redirect directly to. And they'll sign in silently again. And they'll go through CAS, and they'll go into the store and get their mailbox. So all sorts of different flows depending on your namespace configuration and your client configuration. All right, so here's that chart that I mentioned. Again, the one unusual thing, I used to have an arrow actually pointing to it, but for some reason it got dropped off on this slide. But it's this right here, this proxy to mailbox 2013. So that's an Exchange 2007 user trying to get their email via ActiveSync, but we use this proxy mailbox on the 2013 infrastructure to get it to them. Otherwise, excuse me. You can see, for example, by comparison, here's the 2007 experience that we had going to 2010. This is the 2007 experience for 2013, and that's the 2010 experience for 2013. So you can see most of the 2010 experience for 2013 is going to be a simple proxy experience. There's a few places where we might do a cross-site redirect, but it's largely going to be a proxy process from CAS to the mailbox that contains the active copy of that user's mailbox. All right. So switching CAS, Outlook Anywhere, to get Outlook Anywhere to work, you do need to have it enabled on all of your legacy CAS servers. So that's all your 2007 and all your 2010 CAS servers. It has to be running on those. Then you have to set the authentication methods exactly right, because if you don't, users will continuously get prompted for that, and that's a bad experience that typically results in a help desk call for that. So from a 2007 and 2010 perspective, you're going to be using basic authentication for the client and basic and NTLM for IIS. In fact, you have to have NTLM on all of your legacy IIS servers. And on the other side, you want to make sure that your Outlook Anywhere settings for your 2013 are the same on your legacy servers as well. If any of those settings are different, Outlook Anywhere will break and not work for your users. And then for the DNS cutover, in this case, you're also going to want to, a couple days beforehand, put a very low TTL value on that DNS name as well. Because when you do that cutover, you want the clients to get that address fast. Typically, 5 minutes is a good TTL to have on that. If you're using something like 15 minutes or a half hour now, that's maybe acceptable in your organization. It really just depends on how quickly you want your clients to pick up the change. Keep in mind, the low TTL will help you certainly with Outlook clients, but there's also This caching of IP addresses and names that happens separately in web browsers as well. So even if you have a low TTL, the fact that the user still has their web browser open, they may not pick up that change right away. So if you're a web-based only client operation, you're probably going to tell folks just to go ahead and close and reopen the browser. Doing an IP config flush DNS will not be good enough because that's taking care of the OS DNS cache, not the separate browser cache that all browsers have. All right, and then in terms of moving the mailboxes and building out the DAG, the moving mailboxes, it is an online move, like I mentioned before, but we have made some improvements there as well. Specifically, we now have this migration service that allows you to do your mailbox moves in batches. And that batches also includes reporting in terms of how far along we are or which ones completed successfully or didn't complete. And it also has some new built-in retry semantics as well. So if there is some sort of problem during the move, there's retry capabilities that you can have without having the administrator to get involved as well. These batch moves can be done from EAC, so right from the GUI, or of course they can be done via PowerShell with some new commandlets that we've introduced as well. Keep in mind, though, that we also do have a new component called workload management that exists in Exchange as well. And workload management is there to sort of smooth out the peaks and fill in the valleys, if you will, in terms of resource utilization. So in a time where you're doing something that might impact the user experience, like moving a bunch of mailboxes, WOLM has the ability to throttle and kind of slow things down to make sure that if you are doing lots of moves, it doesn't overwhelm the ability to service clients, and it doesn't overwhelm the replication pipeline if you're moving them in and out of a DAG as well. Pardon me? Do we support suspended mailbox moves? Yes. And we also support moves of mailboxes that are on hold as well. So in terms of the migration service, this is just a screenshot showing you the capabilities that you have to go for Exchange Online. Whoops. Migrating to Exchange Online and migrating from Exchange Online can also be done using the same migration service. So both local mailbox moves and remote mailbox moves, all from the one same UI. All right, let's talk about public folder migration. So public folders have also changed significantly. So for one thing, there's no more public folder databases. There's no more public folder replication. There is no more multi-master public folders as well. Public folders now use the mailbox architecture only, so only mailbox databases and recovery databases exist now. Public folders are really just folders inside a mailbox in a mailbox database now. But technically, if you actually looked under the covers in previous versions, that's really not so different from what we were doing before. When you look at the public folder database, for instance, in Exchange 2010, all it really is one mailbox that has its own special separate replication features. That's all it really was forever. Now we've done away with the separate database, so now we have public folder mailboxes with public folder content in those mailboxes located in only one place, not multi-master, so it lives in one place. But because it's a mailbox in a mailbox database, it's replicated in a DAG just like other mailbox databases, and now you have a single HA and site resilience platform for your public folder mailboxes as well, something we really couldn't give you with 2010 and earlier. Now, migration of the public folders themselves is what we call a cutover migration. Legacy public folders and modern public folders cannot coexist. You're either going to be using the legacy ones or the modern ones. Now, the legacy clients cannot access, or the legacy mailbox users, rather, cannot access modern public folders. But new mailbox users, 2013 mailbox users, can access legacy public folders just fine. What that means is before you move any of your public folders, you have to move all of your mailboxes first. After you've done that, then you can go ahead and do the cutover migration to move your public folders. Now, during your mailbox moves, you can sort of set the stage. You sort of prime the modern public folder environment to get ready for move. And basically what happens is you start the process by creating public folder mailboxes, but you put them in a hold state. While they're in this hold state, they're actually in the background asynchronously copying the public folder data from your legacy public folders. And they get to about 90 to 95% of the data migrated over, and then they'll suspend themselves. And they suspend themselves because they're waiting for the admin to take action at that point. And that is to lock the legacy public folders. After they do that, then the rest of the data comes over, and then they can unlock the modern public folders, and users are back in. Now, from the user experience, in particular from the Outlook experience, the users may not notice any changes at all because the migration process carries over all the parent folders, all the child folders, all the permissions, everything. So they probably won't notice anything. An Outlook web app user, though, will have a slightly new and different experience. They will actually need to go in and add public folders to their favorites, one folder at a time. So if you're an Outlook web app user and you're used to using a lot of public folders, it will be a slight period of adjustment for you as you re-add all of your folders. But if you're an Outlook user, it's completely seamless. And of course, the biggest change is on the back end, on the admin side, because again, all of the architectural changes that we made to change from public folder databases to the new ones. So what does it look like? So you've got all your Outlook clients. They're connected to your legacy public folders over here. You take care of making sure that you've done all that you need to do to upgrade and get ready and move the mailboxes, et cetera, et cetera. You can go ahead and take a snapshot of the existing public folders and ferret that away for back-off purposes if you need it. And then we include a script that will analyze your legacy public folders and create what we call a mapping file. And this mapping file will be basically a mapping of where the legacy content lives now and what new modern public folder mailboxes that content is going into. So it's just a text file. You can actually go in there and remove some folders if you don't want them migrated, or change the destination if you want to scale out your public folder mailboxes across many mailboxes, which you can do, or invoke size limits for your mailboxes, maybe cap them at 5 gigs or 10 gigs or whatever you want and so forth. So I have the ability to sort of spread them out based on this mapping file. Then, as I mentioned, you'll create some new public folders, one for the hierarchy and at least one for the content. But you'll use this hold for migration mode, and that is your way of telling Exchange that you actually are still using legacy public folders. So you'll do that, and that'll create those new modern public folders for you, and they'll start the process of migrating the data in the background, but nothing's being used just yet. Then you'll create a migration request to actually do the migration, copy the rest of the data over, and lock the public folders. And then at that point, you'll finalize it. And that's when the final syncing occurs. Any data that was generated after the hold occurred will get replicated over there. The old legacy public folders will get locked. The new modern public folders will become unlocked, and clients will have the ability to connect to public folders again. Absolutely, yes, absolutely. To a very large degree, a public folder mailbox is just like any other mailbox. There are some limitations. You cannot use, for instance, the import and export commandlets against it like you can with a mailbox. You cannot use the recovery or restore commandlets against it like you can a regular mailbox. But for all other purposes, other than what I've just described, so if you want to replicate it in a DAG, you can do that, no problem. If you want to have it be dedicated on that database, you can do. We wouldn't recommend that because generally you're going to want to leverage that database and the storage underneath it. So yeah, fill it with multiple public folder mailboxes or public folder mailboxes and user mailboxes or shared mailboxes and resource mailboxes. They can all coexist on the same database. Now, EWS clients and legacy public folders. So. The web services clients that have mailboxes on 2013 will actually not be able to access the legacy public folders. So once you've upgraded those clients, keep that in mind. You may be kicking them out of the public folder system until you can migrate everything over. Now, if you're doing like a big bang migration over the weekend where everyone's going over at once, maybe not a big deal. But if you're going to be in a period of coexistence for, you know, 4 months, 6 months, or something like that, that could be a big deal for some of those clients there. So it won't be until after you get their mailboxes moved or after you move the public folders over, that these moved mailboxes will be able to access them. So what you might consider doing is maybe moving your EWS clients last. Have them be the very last mailboxes that you move, so that when they're done and when they've moved over, you can go ahead and do the public folder migration right away after that as well. All right. Transport migration, that is super simple. There is no Exchange 2013 Edge Transport Server. But you can very easily use an Exchange 2007 SP3 RU10 or an Exchange 2010 SP3 transport server as well. Both of those will work fine, both from a mail flow perspective and also from a Edge subscription perspective. Of course, you'll be subscribing that Edge transport server to the mailbox server this time, since there is no separate hub role. And then from a general mail flow, it's really up to you as to how you want to go. We typically don't recommend actually going out and changing your MX records until you've got about maybe half of your mailboxes moved over. And the reason for that is there's simply no reason that you need to be in a hurry to do that. 2007 can and 2010 can happily accept mail and route them to 2013 mailbox users. That's not a problem. If you want to switch it right away, you can do that too, because obviously 2013 can route mail to the legacy versions as well. So that's not a problem. But typically, from an actual deployment perspective, we would want you to do this task a little later in the deployment than earlier in the deployment. Some miscellaneous stuff. How many of you are using TMG to publish Exchange today? All right. How many of you don't have a replacement solution for that yet and are worried about that? Okay. Well, that's, you know, valid concern. So we do have a blog post out there that I would strongly recommend those of you who feel that way go and read, because, you know, for one thing, the fact that we stopped selling TMG doesn't really change too much from an operational perspective. It's still going to work. You still already own it. You can still continue to use it. The analogy I use is typically this: you know, if your car dealer stops selling the car that you bought, do you stop driving it? No. You keep driving that car because you bought it, and you'll keep using it until it doesn't drive anymore. Do that with TMG if you want to. Now, you may, in a few years, run out of support on that, but for now, you can easily do that. It's not a problem. There are some nuances that you have to do. Obviously, TMG doesn't really know anything about publishing Exchange 2013, so you will have to go in and manually configure some things, but if you want to still use it, you can. UAG, however, is our long-term strategic application publishing gateway appliance. So UAG is what we would recommend, but it's not quite ready to do 100% of everything we need it to do in Exchange as well. So typically what we talk about is first whether or not you need this functionality. You might actually not need reverse proxy capabilities. You might have only deployed it because we made it really easy to do that with TMG. And you may have deployed maybe 10 years ago when some companies did need reverse proxies and pre-auth and that kind of thing for extra security. But with today's operating systems and with the protocols that we use and all the work that we've done to make Exchange secure by default, secure in deployment, and the defense in depth techniques that we use really mean that you might not actually need reverse proxy capabilities. You might just get a combination load balancer firewall appliance, have that sit in your perimeter network, open up 443 from that to your CAS, and that's a pretty secure implementation. There are some very large deployments of Exchange on the planet that do just that, for an example. All right. Last thing I want to talk about real quick, managing coexistence, super simple. Use the 2013 tools to manage the 2013 objects. Use the legacy tools to manage the legacy objects. It's really that simple. If you got to do something where you're creating a new object on 2007, use the 2007 management console. If you're doing something new in Exchange 2013, use the 2013 tools. It's really that easy. All right. One last thing I want to mention, just so you don't get caught off guard by this, and that is the way we have changed our reporting of quota calculations. So when we tell you the size of a mailbox in Exchange 2010, we're not telling you everything. And in fact, we are really just giving you really just the tip of the iceberg at that point. There's a whole lot of stuff under the surface there that simply isn't reported accurately from a quota perspective. We've changed that in 2013. In 2013, we now give you the exact quota, the exact value of what that mailbox occupies on disk. Now, The actual size of the mailbox will remain unchanged. So when you move a mailbox from 2010 to 2013, that size will be the same. But we're going to tell you it's different because we weren't telling you the right value in 2010. So when you see mailbox sizes that now suddenly look 30%, 35% larger than what we reported, it's not because we got rid of single instance storage or made other storage related changes. It's because we're telling you what it's actually consuming on disk now. Okay? We want to give you the real value so that you can intelligently make capacity planning decisions and understand exactly how much storage each of these mailboxes is consuming. So don't freak out when you see the new values after your migration. It's actually the same value that has always been. We just told you the wrong numbers before. All right. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions. How are we doing on time here? Looks like we're about 5 minutes over, but I will stay here and answer all the questions that you have, starting with this gentleman.
I've got two questions.
Okay. One per person. No, you get two.
You haven't covered hosting mode at all?
No, I haven't. Is there any difference in the process? Yes, there is a tremendous amount of difference in the process in a hosted environment. The best I can give you is a white paper that we have out there, which you probably have already written, which gives you our guidance for doing hosting in Exchange 2013, but doesn't tell you exactly step-by-step how to do that. We give you the guidance on how to upgrade. For instance, we want you to do away with hosting mode and just use the regular product. And once you're in the regular product, use address book policies and some of the other multi-tenant features we have. But ultimately, there's much more to it because you're going to need some form of control panel or provisioning system. And you're going to have a unique multi-tenant environment that is really different from the standard on-premises enterprise deployment. So I would check out that hosting white paper. It doesn't tell you exactly what you need to do, but it does tell you all the things that you need to think about and consider when you're upgrading to 2013 in a hosted environment.
I mean, is that still a track Microsoft's going to follow the whole hosting mode, or are they trying to get rid of it?
Well, we dropped what we called hosting mode back in Exchange 2010. We did that because a lot of the hosters were not happy with the limitations in hosting mode. We didn't have things like public folders available. We didn't have support for Outlook 2003. We didn't have a lot of the bells and whistles. There was no UM in hosting mode, no Edge Transport Server, no Exchange Management Console. It was really limited in what you could do. So after SP1, starting with Exchange 2010 SP2, we said, really move away from hosting mode. You could use SP2 to upgrade hosting mode, but we would really prefer you to break out of hosting mode and use the full product, because then you get all these good features. In 2013, it's the same thing. We've got the multi-tenant capabilities built in, so we don't need a separate hosting mode, but we don't have, as I said, a lot of guidance out there yet for hosters on all the things that they need to do in their environment. It's just really more of a general thing of, you know, all the things that you would need to think of.
Is SP3 going to break it like
SP2? Is SP3 going to break it like SP2? You mean, is CU3 going to break it like CU2 is? I hope not. As mystified as you are by our missteps here. And the reality is we have no excuse. We've screwed up several times in a row with our updates. And I apologize to all of you, anyone who's inconvenienced by that. And the reality is there's nothing I can say that will change it. I think only time will tell if we get our act together and ship an update without a bug. Yes, sir. Sure, great. So the primary and secondary refer to the hierarchy mailboxes. So those are the mailboxes that have the trees. Now, all public folder mailboxes have a copy of the hierarchy, but only one of them is writable. That's what we call the primary hierarchy. We still have these secondary hierarchies because we wanted to maintain the same concept of a sort of a public folder home mailbox. Because when an Outlook client connects, we don't want to send them all to the writable hierarchy. We'll intercept those changes that they make them and send them over there. But if all we want to do is just display the tree for them and have them navigate the tree, we send them to the closest public folder mailbox we can find. And once they're there, they see the hierarchy. When they click on a folder, then at that point, they'll go to the exact public folder mailbox that contains that content. But the whole purpose of the secondary hierarchy is just to let Outlook open up and get the tree very fast from any public folder mailbox it connects to. Yes, sir. Will the public folders archive like a normal mailbox? You mean, can you apply retention policies against them? Unfortunately, no. That's another thing you cannot do. There's no retention policies that can be applied. And while we're on the subject of limitations, we don't have e-discovery for public folders as well. And so I don't want you to think you can't search them. An Outlook or OWA user could go in and search them just like they can every folders. But when we're doing e-discovery from the Exchange e-discovery center or from the SharePoint e-discovery center, which can look into mailboxes, we cannot use public folder mailboxes for that as well. Oh, yes. Oh, I'm completely forgetting about the gifts. So I think I think there's already two gift-worthy. I think that's secondary hierarchy and the archiving. So I'll give you your choice. There's headsets here, and then there's a bag with someone's laundry and used coffee cup. No, it's a T-shirt and an office mug. So I'll give you your choice of that. And then I'll think of, actually, let's give this away before too many people leave. So how many of you were here for the video at the beginning? The trivia video, okay. Can anybody tell me the name of the movie I stole all of that music from? Raise your hand if you know it. What? No, I've never even heard of that. Is that a movie? Yeah, is that a movie? No. Happy Dogs? No, that's me, but the music is not mine. I will give you a hint. The name of the band is M83. Does that help anyone? What movie did they just score? It's awesome. I've watched it a million times. You have to see this movie. What? Not Warm Bodies, but also an awesome movie. Yes, Oblivion. We have a winner. Very good. Very good. Very good. Excellent. Okay, other questions? Back to technology. Yes. Pardon me? How's replication handled for public folders? The only way to replicate public folder mailbox content is by replicating that mailbox database in a DAG. So with public folder mailboxes, you'll also have this concept of the active mailbox and the passive mailbox. No more geographic locations. Yeah, it's single master. There's no multi-master. There's no merging. There's no public folder conflicts or anything like that. It only lives in one place. All right, anything else? Yes, sir. Shh. Actually, if you guys could keep it down so we can hear the question. Yes. Down to two roles, CAS and mailbox. Well, unified messaging lives mostly in the mailbox role, but there's a UM call router component that's on CAS as well. Yeah, we wanted to, so the consolidation of the server roles served us several benefits. One was we get simplified deployment. I mean, there's only two roles now. You can't get too much simpler than that. But we also, when we make major architectural changes like this, it's largely a reflection of changes in hardware. So when you think about when we went to 2003 to 2007, we moved from 32-bit to 64-bit, but we needed greater scalability. When we were designing 2007, we didn't have things like multi-core processors available. So the server roles were actually introduced as a recognition of that, as a way to achieve greater scalability, given the limitations of the hardware. With 2010, we carried that forward, but eventually we got multi-core processors, and that's when we went to promoting multi-role for everyone. And since we were promoting multi-role for everyone, it started to make a lot of sense to consolidate those roles into one role in Exchange 2013. Again, largely as a reflection of the hardware that was available. Mm-hmm. Yes. No, in 2010, in certain 2010 implementations, we want you to put UM there. If you've got a very large UM deployment, or if you're using things like UM archiving or voicemail transcription or the auto attendant features, then you might need a larger platform to account for the extra CPU needs. You could always throw that in the same box, but some customers like splitting that out to get that guaranteed quality of service. 2013 has been specifically designed with all four roles on one box combined. So we've taken care of all of that in terms of any additional overhead that would be needed from a 2013 perspective. So with UM, for example, in a multi-role, you would figure maybe 100 concurrent calls per server. You'd figure that we'll do voicemail transcript automatically by default unless it's longer than 75 seconds, in which case we won't do it because of the CPU hit. And then, of course, just as we did in the past, if there's so much activity going on where we don't have the CPU time, we'll also skip the voicemail transcript and send it across. But all the same functionality, you know, marking something as private or urgent, the inline player that you get with the message and the transcription, all that remains largely unchanged. Although I will say that the HA story gets a lot better for UM as well, because now it's all on the one role, and because these roles are decoupled and they can be basically recovered independently, if all you need to do is move mailbox over, you could very easily move UM over with it as well. It's super simple.
Do you still have to uninstall languages and reinstall them?
Pardon me?
Do you still have to uninstall languages and then reinstall?
The language packs? No, but we do have separate language packs that you would install separately as well. And we do that on purpose so that we can service those more quickly. And in fact, we have added something else around those lines. So if you come to the tips and tricks session, I'll show you one thing else we did around language and fast updating as well. Yes? Nothing additional. It's still going to be building a new DAG. It's still going to be moving the mailboxes online. Nothing particularly challenging given that you're CCR and SCR. Eventually, you'll decommission that environment, though, and have a much better platform. Yes? Disabling. Well, for one thing, you can. Do you need any HTTP access coming into your mail servers? Are you using OWA or ActiveSync or anything like that? Because it really depends on what you need to come in and what you need to go out. You can certainly not publish that virtual directory. That's one way to cut it off. You can remove the external URL access. That's another way to cut it off, although that may have implications for your OWA clients if you have them. Or you can, there's one other way. Yeah, there's one other way that I'm spacing on right now. You know what? No? What's that? No, that won't do it. Yeah, send that to me in email, and I'll send you all three things.
Yeah.
Pardon me? Yeah, well, that would be the non-publishing. It takes care of that, too. Yeah. That's easier because then you don't have to change security. Yes? How is it a security problem with cache data? To who? You don't have your devices password protected or BitLockered or anything like that? Okay. Yeah. So just to be cleared, Outlook Anywhere refers to the underlying protocol. That does not mean that it's in cache mode versus online mode. If you want to run Outlook Anywhere in online mode so there's no cache, that would work for you too.
Yeah, but with Outlook Anywhere turned off, you can't tell how the client's configured.
I'm not sure what you mean. You can't tell how it's configured. Right. So do you control, are these domain join machines that are accessing? So you have no control over, so you couldn't even lock it down if you wanted to. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so that's going to be some form of a block that you'll put on your firewall and your policy. Again, send that to me in email, and I'll send you the links on what we have on that. All right, time for one more question. Actually, time for three more questions. Let's see. You did get one of those for your question. I did offer you one before, and you get one there. And so we've got time for one more question for the full office bag, complete with T-shirt. Kind of a small T-shirt, and the coffee mug. Great question. So no, you just leave it in place. Any functionality in 2010 for clients that may still be connecting directly, they'll continue to use it, but otherwise you won't need it in 2013. It's completely gone. Correct. That's correct. That's correct. Yes. Yes. If you have, so when we say, yes, that's a good distinction. When we say site in Exchange, that's analogous to data center and analogous to AD site. So we use those terms interchangeably. So yes, you wouldn't want a load balancer across multiple AD sites. All right. All right, that's it for tonight. Thanks for staying.